On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with anthropologist and publisher of the Paraanthropology Journal, Jack Hunter.
Does this ability manifest itself more in some people than in others? And obviously we know it does. But particularly what I think you bring that I had never thought of and I think is an interesting thing to kind of grind on is it more prevalent in certain cultures? Is it more prevalent in certain social situations with certain combinations of events, people, rituals, practices, all those things? And I just think that's mind-blowing. I mean, that opens it up in so many different ways. Am I in the right direction? And what are your thoughts on that specifically in terms of what might be the directions that folks might want to go to find this phenomena manifesting itself more frequently, more measurably, all the rest of that stuff?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. When you look at the anthropological literature or the ethnographic literature and look at the kinds of experiences that people have reported to anthropologists in the field all over the world, you find these kind of common characteristics. For instance, like you said, ritual is a major, it's an important process for people to go through in order to have these kinds of experiences. And I think that the parapsychological community has missed out on that. They could, for instance, use ritualized procedures in the laboratory. That's one example. Or take the laboratory out to the rituals.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, Jack Hunter, someone I've been looking forward to talking to for quite some time. He was suggested to me or brought to my attention to me by you, listeners, and I'm so glad you did. His work in paraanthropology is really fantastically mind-bending for me in some ways that I found very, very interesting. So let's get right to the interview. Afterwards, I have a couple of thoughts, want to bring you up to date on just a couple of things that are going on, and I have a question for you from this interview. So here goes. Today, we welcome Jack Hunter to Skeptico. Jack is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Archaeology and Anthropology at the University of Bristol in the UK. He's the author of a very, very interesting book called Talking with the Spirits. And you may know him through his publication, his online journal that he's done for several years now, which is called Paraanthropology. Jack, it's been very interesting diving into your work. I've kind of heard about you for a couple years and always thought it was such great, great work that you're doing. And I'm certainly happy to have you on Skeptico. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
You know, as we were just chatting about really briefly there, what I thought we might do is start with some of the basics. First off, a little bit more about your background, about your PhD work there at Bristol and your work in the Department of Archaeology and Anthropology, and then certainly some background on this very groundbreaking, brave-to-publish journal that you have, Paraanthropology. So do you want to kind of kick us off with some background stuff?
Yeah, okay. So I first really became active in this kind of paranormal stuff when I finished my first university degree at the University of Bristol. And for my dissertation for that degree, I wrote about a group of spirit mediums in Bristol and really sort of became interested in the kinds of experiences they were having. And then once I finished my degree, I kind of wanted to carry on working with this group and delving into it a little deeper. So I applied to do a PhD to look further at it. And fortunately, I was given the opportunity to do it. But it's all been self-funded. I haven't had any like major grants. And then the Paraanthropology Journal kind of came out of that. At the time, my supervisor, Fiona Bowie, was setting up this group called the Afterlife Research Centre based at Bristol. And the group was specifically concerned with thinking about the afterlife in the cross-cultural context. So looking at afterlife beliefs in different cultures. And there was quite a heavy emphasis on spirit mediumship and shamanism. And at one of the meetings of the Afterlife Research Centre, we started to talk about the need for a journal in the UK that dealt with these kind of issues. I mean, in the US, there's the Journal of the Society for the Anthropology of Consciousness, which deals with similar things, but there's not much in the UK. So I just thought I'd go ahead and do it.
Great, great. You know, the other thing I wanted to kind of use as a starting point is tell us about anthropology. I mean, I guess we all know it as we kind of walk through the museum and they say, oh, this is anthropology. This is what anthropologists do. But in talking to a couple of anthropologists, I get the sense that I'm not really connected with, I guess, the mindset, because I think there's a very cool, progressive, kind of expansive mindset, at least among some anthropologists, I guess not all. But, you know, what is it really about? What do you guys do? What is the field work like? What is the science behind it? And what is the scientific status of it within the university? What do other people think about anthropology?
Okay. Well, very basically, anthropology is the study of human beings. So I take that in quite a broad way. And obviously all of my research into the paranormal and things like that comes under the banner of human life, because humans do these things regardless of whether these things are real or not. So for an anthropologist, studying human beings, there's specific ways that they do it. And the chief methodology that they use is ethnography, which is basically going into the field, living with people and trying to immerse yourself in their life as deeply as possible, and then writing it. And then from that, deducing, you know, perhaps grander theories that can be applied more broadly to human culture. And that's kind of anthropology in a nutshell. For me, though, my fieldwork has been based with this group of spirit mediums in an urban context. So you hear about anthropologists going off to Africa or, you know, the Middle East, or, you know, anywhere in the world, basically. But you can also do anthropology at home. And that's kind of what I've done. And the interesting thing about spirit mediumship is that anthropology's had a really long history of investigating spirit mediums, going right back to the very early days of the discipline. But it's always been off in far off distant lands, and very little research has actually been done on spirit mediums sort of within the Western context. It's almost as though anthropology hasn't really wanted to face up to the fact that these things aren't just out there. They're also at home as well.
Yeah.
So my research has tried to do that a little bit.
And how does that sit with the rest of the college there, the rest of the disciplines? I mean, how do they view anthropology? Kind of as these quirky guys who are okay as long as they stay out there with the Aborigines and the other... Yeah. But, you know, what is it like, especially when you kind of bring it back home like that?
Mm. Well, I haven't had any negative experiences with it. I mean, in terms of my involvement in the department, I'm not really there very often. I live in Wales, which is quite a way away from Bristol.
But I do sense, and again, I'm just kind of wading into the waters here, so I may be kind of totally off base. But, you know, just some of the stuff that comes through from even kind of more mainstream anthropology does seem to kind of bump up against some sacred cows, just in terms of experience, for example.
Yeah.
In one of your essays that I found on your very nicely done website at academia.edu, you mentioned taking experience seriously. What are the consequences? And it's one of those little parts of this whole thing that, on one hand, seems so basic. I think, you know, if you just told the kind of man on the street this, what are the consequences of taking experience seriously? And that being this kind of deep philosophy of science kind of question that we really have to wrestle with, I think people would just be stunned. I mean, what do you mean we have to take experience seriously? Of course we take experience seriously.
Yeah. Well, what I mean by taking experience seriously is in anthropology, anthropologists going out into the field always come up against these, or come across these people who have completely, you know, disparate kinds of experiences to what the anthropologist is used to. And, anthropologists have traditionally written about these experiences, but in a kind of almost kind of, a dismissive way. So for instance, experiences of spirit mediumship might be mentioned, but they won't be delved into. It's not like they want to find out what these experiences actually are. they can see that people do have experiences that are unusual, for instance, but they're not generally willing to take that extra step and analyze the experience in itself, kind of taking a deep phenomenological approach to experience. And that's something that I'm particularly interested in, because when you come up with these, come across these strange experiences of mediumship and all the kinds of shamanism and out-of-body experiences and stuff, those experiences seem to suggest something that the kind of dominant worldview of our own culture is kind of dismissive of, it kind of ignores. I think taking those experiences seriously is an important step for anthropology.
It's a huge step, because really when you talk about our culture, you're talking about science as we know it. You're talking about the established scientific paradigm that is pervasive throughout every university, and that's that we should not take these experiences seriously, particularly when they go into these areas that you're talking about that contradict this idea of consciousness being this product of the brain that we can measure very precisely and all the rest of that. So I guess what I'm saying is, it seems to me that anthropology is open in some ways, because just being progressive in nature, it's kind of moved away from, I think, that outdated idea that we can all look at and say, well, gee, of course, we have to be more accepting of other cultures. And we've seen that throughout history, the whole cultural bias that we can place in terms of saying the primitives, you know, these primitive people with primitive ideas. And I think anthropology is a discipline that's kind of helped us rise above that and see in a more culturally inclusive way that we can't do that. And I think your work is just a natural extension of that. That's what I get the sense of, that anthropology is kind of in somewhat of a unique position to be more receptive to jumping the chasm and saying, well, if I'm taking these other experiences of their culture, of their society seriously, well, then of course I should consider taking these paranormal experiences seriously, at least from an experiential basis, from the fact that they say they've had it. Am I wrong there? Is anthropology maybe in a better position to explore some of this than, let's say, neuroscience is, because they're totally wed to this idea that mind equals brain?
Yeah, I really think that is the case. Anthropology, because of its very nature as a discipline that's involved with, you know, real life human beings who have real life experiences, we have to be open to those aspects of other people's, you know, whole world view. There's no way we can escape from having to deal with it, which is, you know, what anthropologists have tended to try and do, is not worry about what the implications of those kinds of experiences actually are. I think that's what my work is, really an extension of that idea, towards taking these experiences that people have seriously and not dismissing them.
Tell us some more about your work, specifically your field work with your medium group there in the UK, because I think people just find it fascinating. The actual nuts and bolts and what you've discovered and some of the experiences you've shared in doing that work.
Yeah. Well, the group that I've been working with was founded, I think, in about 2006 by a lady who had been invited to attend a physical mediumship seance, which is with ectoplasm and all of those kind of things, floating objects and stuff. And she basically had her mind blown by the experience. And when she got home, she decided that she wanted to kind of, in her own kind of scientific way, to delve into this a little bit deeper and try and find out what exactly it was that she experienced in the seance room. So to do this, she decided she would set up her own spirit lodge, essentially, and invite people in who would go on to develop as mediums, and then basically take things into her own hands and develop the mediums herself from scratch and record all of her experiences and their experiences along the way. So when I came to write my dissertation for my undergraduate degree, I was interested in the reasons why people believe in spirits, just out of my own interest. And I wanted to find some way of exploring that idea through ethnography. And I visited a few spiritualist churches and things like that, but I wasn't able to really kind of get the kind of deep participation I wanted to get into. I don't know why that is. I think it might be because these spiritualist churches have got constantly fluctuating attendance. And so I was basically just like, I'd turn up, and if I didn't turn up the next day, it didn't really matter, because that's just what people do in those kind of churches.
Huh.
So I found this group, which just happened to be, by some kind of weird synchronicity, about a 20-minute walk down the road from where I was living at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this interesting website and a blog. It was full of all of these accounts of weird things that they'd seen and these communications from their spirit teams. I was like, oh, this seems like the perfect opportunity, you know, to talk to people who actually communicate with spirits on a regular basis. So I went along, and it was, you know, very interesting. The very first seance I went to was on a really cold winter's morning. I think it was in January, and I had to trek through the snow to get there. And instantly it broke down my preconceived ideas about what a seance was, because it was in the morning. I usually assumed that they would be, you know, in the at night in the dark. But we went out into the shed in their back garden, literally like a small wooden shed. And inside it was all done up with a circle on the floor and a cabinet in the corner, and chairs all around the edge of the room. And the medium came in and sat down in the cabinet and went into this kind of trance, and her body was twitching and all of these things. It was really amazing to see. I'd never seen anything like it before. And they switched the red lights on. And then I saw these like little flashes of light and things like that, which at the very least made me think that there was some kind of, again, coming back to experience, there's some kind of experiences that you can have in these kind of situations, regardless of what their ultimate ontological status is. So that was kind of my impetus to keep researching the group. Because from the very first seance I went to, I myself had had, you know, strange, anomalous experiences, if you want to call them those.
Yeah, absolutely. So as an anthropologist, you're walking into this seance. What are you thinking, in specifically, what methodologies, what tools, how are you thinking you're going to approach this as an anthropologist? And then if you could, is there anything, you said this kind of shattered some of your preconceived ideas about mediumship. It sounds like it might have shattered some of your preconceived ideas about reality and consciousness as well. How do you deal with that, given your discipline?
Mm. Well, anthropology, again, in general, and ethnography, the whole point of it is to go into the situation in as kind of open-minded a position as you possibly can.
Right, but how do you do that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's impossible, right? So you're trying to hold to that, but how does that really play out?
I don't know if it is impossible.
When I say it's impossible, it's impossible because we know from psychology basics, mm-hmm. we see what we are conditioned to see. So, I mean, I think it's important. I'm not trying to challenge you on this. I think it's an important discipline, and to be trained to try and, you know, pull back your biases like a police detective or something like that. And, you know, but we can't totally distance ourselves from our past, our conditioning, and all the rest of that.
No.
What happens when your whole world is turned upside down, when you see something that's totally outside your belief system? You're the perfect guy to do it because you've been trained to do it, but it still has to be somewhat of a trippy experience.
Yeah, it is a strange experience. But I think just thinking about what you've just said there, it made me think that the whole process is kind of like an active process. It's not like you go in there and you're passive and you just let it all wash over you. Like if you see something that you, for instance, you might not believe, whatever that means, like seeing something levitate in the room and you don't believe it, you've got to actively try to kind of suppress your disbelief and just go with the flow of what's happening. And then with ethnography, what you do at the end is you write it all up. And then you can kind of explore some of the ideas. You can explore the way the people who were involved in it experienced it, and also how you yourself experienced it. But do that afterwards. When you're there, you should be as much like engaged in it as you possibly can. And suspending your disbelief. That's definitely what I did anyway. My supervisor's come up with this interesting methodology. She calls it cognitive empathetic engagement. And basically, you'll have to read her papers to really like get the full rounded picture of what she means when she talks about this. But it is this kind of trying to see the world as other people see it, So not dismissing it, not ignoring these aspects of experience, and trying to understand how those kinds of experience then go on to influence the worldview of the people that you're studying. And I think basically that's what my research has done, or has tried to do overall.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And again, maybe this is a little bit off topic, but I don't think it is, because I see that Dr. Julie Boschel has written a nice review of one of your yes. books there. So you're obviously familiar with her work.
Yep.
What is the feedback loop, if you will, like in these areas of anthropology, para-anthropology, which we'd have to kind of break apart that word and talk about what we really mean, because para is such a kind of pejorative term sometimes. I don't, you know, it's almost like you attach it to anything and immediately undervalues yeah. it. But let's leave that aside for a second. What is the feedback loop like between these strange anomalous phenomena that you're encountering and a more kind of straightforward scientific analysis of whether those phenomena are quote unquote real or some kind of illusion or trick of the brain that we hear about so much from our friends in the anomalistic psychology kind of yeah. area? The reality of it or non-reality of it, I mean, on one hand, I hear you saying, well, that doesn't really matter. It's what the people are experiencing or think they're yeah. experiencing. But on another level, hell yes, it matters. It's the
yeah,
only
it does
thing
matter.
That matters.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the strange things about my kind of perspective on it. Because on the one hand, I am very interested in whether it's real or not. And that's where my interest in parapsychology comes into all of this. Then at the other end of the spectrum, there's my kind of like social science side of myself that's more interested in how the people experience and incorporate these experiences into their lives and all of those kind of things. But one of the things I wanted to do with Paranthropology, with the journal, was to kind of make a space where both anthropologists and parapsychologists could come together and kind of share ideas on what's going on in these kind of situations. I mean, there are anthropologists who have done parapsychological experiments in the field as well, which is quite an interesting area. An anthropologist called Patrick Giesler, for instance, has done work with PK experiments in the field in the Amazon with some positive results as well. But yeah, that kind of crossover is what I'm really interested in.
Indeed. And Jack, you have some interesting thoughts in terms of how maybe parapsychology could move forward quicker, better, by incorporating in some of the sensibility that you've gained through this kind of anthropological approach to these phenomena. Do you want to kind of expound on that?
Yeah, I think what I've written about previously is the way that parapsychological experiments take these experiences that people have, generally spontaneous experiences, and have tried to reduce them down to, to phenomena that are really easy to investigate in the lab. I mean, obviously, it's an important thing to do, because that's how you get solid proof of things. But through looking at the kind of social processes that are involved in these kinds of experiences, which is what anthropologists do, parapsychologists could, for instance, could learn ways of making their experiments more true to real life. Does that make sense? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's kind of two interesting ways to pull that apart. I mean, one is when I've heard from parapsychologists, and in particular, I remember Dean Radin saying this, which I thought was very appropriate. I mean, he's a super smart guy and I respect him yeah. a lot. But he said, look, you know, we had to bring it into the lab because, well, he didn't say that. He said, you know, one of the benefits you get in bringing it into the lab is understanding the nature of the phenomena in terms of whether it's an innate quality, an innate ability in humans, or mm-hmm. whether it is particular to certain human beings or certain cultures and all the rest of that. And that's an important question. And the only way you yeah. can answer that is through that. But I think what you're pointing out, and I totally agree with, is that, okay, once you answer that question, you check that checkbox, then you might want to circle back around and say a couple of other questions. One is, does this ability manifest itself more in some people than in others? And obviously we know it does. But particularly, what I think you bring that I had never thought of, and I think is an interesting thing to kind of grind on, is it more prevalent in certain cultures? Is it more prevalent in certain social situations with certain combinations of events, people, rituals, practices, all those things? And I just think that's mind-blowing. I mean, that opens it up in so many different ways. Am I in the right direction? And what are your thoughts on that specifically in terms of what might be the directions that folks might want to go to find this phenomena manifesting itself more frequently, more measurably, all the rest of that stuff?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. When you look at the anthropological literature or the ethnographic literature and look at the kinds of experiences that people have reported to anthropologists in the field all over the world, you find these kind of common characteristics. For instance, like you said, ritual is a major, how can I say it? It's an important process for people to go through in order to have these kinds of experiences. And I think that the parapsychological community has missed out on that. They could, for instance, use ritualized procedures in the laboratory.
Mm.
That's one example. Or take the laboratory out to the rituals. The only problem is trying to maintain the kind of natural quality that a real ritual would have. But those are the kinds of areas that I think that more research needs to be done. Like, what is actually, parapsychologically speaking, going on in rituals? Like, is PK being used? You know, all of those kinds of questions. But the other useful thing about the anthropological and ethnographic approach is seeing the kind of social processes that give rise to paranormal experiences. So what kind of social and cultural prerequisites are there for the manifestation of kind of robust parapsychological phenomena?
Fascinating. What are some of your kind of intuitive hunches in terms of what we might find out if we go down those paths?
Well, yeah, I think the obvious will be found that rituals have evolved or developed over thousands of years because they are efficacious or possibly efficacious. So rituals for instance, divination mm-hmm. have developed because they do actually work. So it'd be interesting to do, parapsychological experiments on these traditional divination rituals to find out if it is the same kind of phenomenon that seems to be occurring in parapsychological experiments in the lab, to find out if it is that they're tapping into. I think that's something that an anthropologist called Michael Winkelmann was getting at in an article he published in, I think it was in 1982, in which he basically challenged anthropologists to take seriously the evidence from parapsychology, which suggests that there's some kind of psi process going on,
mm-hmm.
and to think about what that kind of data implies for the sort of anthropological theorizing on magic.
How about what that data implies for parapsychology or just science? We can't really go there because science totally ignores all this stuff. Mm. But what does it mean in terms of what's really going on, I guess? I guess I could jump in two different directions. I could see some kind of morphic field, Rupert Sheldrake kind of thing, where repeating a pattern, repeating a ritual somehow creates some kind of synergy with an existing field that then makes something more possible. Or I could see something on a kind of more extended human consciousness, there being other dimensions of consciousness that we can only even speculate about, having some order in some reality that we have to tap into in some different ways to make these things happen. Do you care to even speculate in terms of what direction this could possibly take us?
That's a tough question, that one. For me, personally, I think it's too early to really come up with any kind of like solid, definitive model of what's going on. But I do think that whatever it is that's going on, it's going to be way more complicated than we're even aware of at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It seems as though from parapsychological experiments that there is some kind of psi phenomenon, some kind of processes that human beings can tap into. But as for the wider kind of cosmic scale, I really don't know. but it's probably going to be very weird.
Probably going to be very weird. I bet you're right. But how do you balance the speaking to and within the existing paradigm, which we have to be kind of careful to honor and respect because it is the dominant paradigm? I don't have to, but you have to because you're seeing your PhD. You're trying to succeed in an academic world that has certain constructs. I mean, where do you draw the line? I noticed like in one of your papers, you said you're agnostic regarding the mind-brain identity theory, mind equals brain as we talk about it. I don't believe for a second that you're agnostic about it, but I think you have to maintain that you're agnostic about it. I mean, can we really go forward within the existing paradigm, playing this little game over, this little side game over here and just hoping that no one notices, but then at the same time wanting everyone to notice? I mean, how do we play out that dynamic?
It's, again, another very tricky question. The paradigm that we've got at the moment, basically, either it needs to be completely overhauled and replaced, or it needs some kind of expansion, like an expansion pack added onto it.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not sure how, with this current paradigm, we really can move on. There's going to have to be some kind of change, either that or we all just give up researching this stuff. But I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't think it should happen.
No, it shouldn't happen. It's interesting that actually the next issue of Paranthropology, which should be coming out at the end of this month, has been guest edited by Dr. Mark Schroll. And he's given the issue the title of Hypotheses in Search of a Paradigm. And I think probably you'll find that issue particularly interesting. It's got lots of contributions from Stanley Krippner in it. But yeah, I think that kind of sums up the situation at the moment. We've got all of these hypotheses about psi and things like that, but there's no paradigm to kind of tie it all together. So yeah, that we definitely need some kind of new paradigm, I think. But what that new paradigm is, I don't know.
Okay, Jack, while we have you here, tell us folks a little bit more about your book, Talking with Spirits, because to be honest with you, I hadn't really discovered it until a couple days ago. So I haven't had a chance to read it. I've just dipped into it. I heard a really fascinating interview you gave about the book. It sounds really, really interesting. Tell folks a little bit about what they're going to find if they pick that up.
Okay, so the book is it's called Talking with the Spirits, Ethnographies from Between the Worlds. And basically, it's a cross-cultural survey of spirit mediumship and spirit possession practices around the world. And it's got 12 different chapters from various different cultural contexts. So the first chapter, for instance, is a more kind of general overview and a musing on the role of skepticism in ethnography. And then we've got a few chapters on mediumship in the Western context. So stuff on mediumship in Great Britain and Montreal in Canada. And then even stuff on mediumship in just the internet and cyber psychics. And then it goes on to discuss spirit possession in East Africa and then off into Cuba, Brazil, where mediumship is massive. And then finally, it goes over to Asia with Charles Emmons looking at spirit mediums in Hong Kong and another anthropologist, Fabian Graham, looking at mediumship in Singapore and Taiwan. So it's got quite a lot of stuff in there. And I think one of the main aims of the book was to show that mediumship isn't just what we see in the Western context. There's a lot more to mediumship than, you know, ectoplasm and table tipping and platform mediums. It's a really broad, almost near universal human phenomenon.
And what do you make of that diversity? I guess that gets right back to the huge question we were talking about that we can't really fully penetrate, but just at the most basic level, what's your biggest takeaway from the broad diversity of these experiences that all fit pretty nicely also within the context of what we think about in terms of mediumship?
Yeah. The broad takeaway message, I think, is that there seems to be something going on.
Yeah.
There's something that human beings are kind of tapping into, or at least trying to tap into, which suggests, again, that there's something going on. I don't know what that something ultimately will be, but you know, people have been doing it as far back as you care to look and as far abroad as you care to look as well. even right in our own like back gardens and garden sheds, as I found. It's all there. It's all happening, which is very interesting.
You know, just to underline a point that you made earlier about going in your own backyard, I think if there maybe is a blind spot traditionally in anthropology, it's to see the others as being somehow different than we are. And I think that's been, I guess, a specific aim of your work to kind of take a different perspective. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And I guess I just would like to add one more thing to what you said. It's happening, I guess, is one of the takeaways. And I maybe another takeaway is anyone who attempts to pin it down and say, it's this, it's happening because it's this, because it's Satan through the Bible as described in verse, chapter, this, that doesn't really fit. Or people who want to say that it's some kind of new age consciousness changing UFO related, not put down UFOs, but you know, it's this. It's very difficult to say it's this, you know, it's difficult to say it's not this, but it's also difficult to say it is this, right?
Yes, it is. And that's one of the things, again, why I think that anthropologists taking note of what's been going on in parapsychology and the study of mediums for the past 130 years is so important, because over and over again, anthropologists come to the conclusion that spirit mediumship, you know, either it serves purely social functional purposes, or it's a product of cognitive misfirings in the brain or whatever. But none of these sort of grand models that they come up with really actually, when you look at it and how it's played out in the field, actually explains what's going on. And parapsychology has taken that bold step of tackling the ontological questions about what's really real. And I think that's an interesting avenue for anthropology to explore, because it's got huge implications for the rest of sciences and for the dominant paradigm, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely. Jack, tell people more about how they can dive into your work. You have so many great essays up there that people can download for free and really jump into this stuff. Tell folks how to get there and how to do it.
The easiest way to get hold of all the paranthropology issues, and there's 17, the 18th issue is coming out at the end of this month, is just to go to www.paranthropology.co.uk, or just search for paranthropology on Google, and it should come up pretty easily. There's a whole load of articles on there that'll be of interest to people. There's also a paranthropology book that was published in 2012 to celebrate the second anniversary of the journal, and it kind of picked the cream of the crop of those 2 years. And you can find that quite easily. You can search for it on Amazon and Paranthropology. It's on the website. And I'm hoping to get another book together, because this year is actually the fourth anniversary of the journal. So I'm hoping to get another book together that will look at the best articles from the past 2 years and hopefully get that out sometime next year. That's the plan anyway.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. We'll look for that. And I'm also going to provide a link in the show notes to your website at academia.edu, because you also have some other nice information on your work in particular there. So we want to introduce people to that. Jack, it's been great having you on. We certainly wish you the best of luck with this work going forward. And I hope you'll come back on at some point and update us on where your work is leading you.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Jack Hunter for joining me today on Skeptico. A couple of quick notes. One, I wanted to mention a little bit about Skeptico 3.0, which is a concept that I floated out there a few episodes ago, and it has to do with how the show might be going forward. And one of the things that has kind of come out of that I really like, and I really think we can build on, is this idea of doing follow-up interviews and building that into the process. So what I'm doing for a couple of shows that we're working on right now is I'm doing the interview, then I'm previewing the interview to some Skeptico listeners who have expressed an interest in the interview, and they've expressed that interest by going to the forum, and when I announce an upcoming interview, then they're in there saying, hey, here are some of the questions, here's some of the other work this person has done, here's where I think this interview might need to go. So I'm trying to post those forum entries for upcoming interviews on a pretty regular basis. So if you're into the forum, you might want to check for those. And then if you have some good comments there, I'm going to invite you to listen to a pre-release of the interview right after I record it. And then we can engage in a dialogue about what should be the follow-on questions. Because I think the follow-on questions, as I've mentioned so many times in this show, are really where the work gets done in terms of changing thinking on my part, or maybe expanding the thinking of my guests, if I can be so bold as to say that. But that's where some of the fun stuff really happens. So if you'd like to be part of that process, please pop on over to the forum and join the discussion over there. And I think, as I just laid out, you can get into that and it'll be great. You'll be helping me, and hopefully you'll be more engaged in the topic so that you can get more out of them, which is always my hope and intent. So check that out if you're interested. The second thing I wanted to mention, and it's also kind of been going on in the Skeptico forum, and it's a follow-on again to something that I mentioned in a previous show, is I've really tried to reach out with my old friends in the skeptic and atheist community. Now, I don't want to push this too far, and I don't want to make anyone super uncomfortable, but for a long time, I've had this kind of anytime, anywhere challenge out there to engage, to dialogue. It doesn't have to be a debate, but it sometimes evolves into a debate. But it just strikes me as stunning that all the prominent people in the skeptical communities, quote unquote, are unwilling to engage in critical discussions about science. I mean, come on, the points that I would make are science points. They're all right there in the book. They have to do with the nature of consciousness, near-death experience, all the other stuff that we talk about on this show, the link of spirituality and consciousness. How can these be topics that these folks are not willing to engage in? And yet they're not. And it really reconfirms what I've stated many times that I've discovered, which is these folks are exactly like the Christians that they so rail against, who just want to be left alone to believe what they want and not be challenged on their beliefs. Well, I guess that's well enough. That's not the way I like to operate. Not when you're publicly out there proclaiming yourself to be a critical thinker, proclaiming that you're willing to carefully analyze the evidence and come to the best conclusion possible. I mean, there's a huge contradiction there. So in my process of reaching out and trying to create that dialogue, I've also asked skeptical listeners to reach out and do that. So if you're connected to anyone who has a blog, a prominent blog or a prominent podcast, or is a writer in the skeptical or atheist, they go hand in hand community, please invite them to dialogue, to engage. And I don't care where it's done. It can be done on the skeptical platform. It can be done on their platform. I don't care about the format. It can be a structured debate where each person has an allotted time. It can be a free flow discussion. I'm really a pretty easy guy to talk to, as you know, from listening to these shows. I mean, I'm not going to shout somebody down. So if there's anyone out there who can help facilitate that and make that happen, I think that'd be great. I'd love to do it. And I think it'd make for good skeptico listening. So then finally, on to a question to tee up from this episode. And what came to mind for me was an extension of a question that we've asked previously. And that is, what about this experience thing? Does experience matter? And obviously, I think it does. And I think that's one of the real blind spots of science, is that they've really danced around and, for the most part, ignored the whole idea of experience. So the extension of that, that Jack Hunter so beautifully kind of transitions to in this interview and in his work, is what does experience mean from a social standpoint? What is the experience of culture? And how does that matter? What is the experience of ritual, even in this small group that has this ritual? What is that collective experience, and how might that matter? So I think it does two things. One, it opens up a whole bunch of questions about that and about how ritual might matter and how culture might matter. But it also, I think, further highlights this blind spot that experience has to be able to be brought back into the equation and can't be written off as an illusion, just something that's happening inside the brain and doesn't really matter scientifically. So that's the question I tee up. Of course, the place to respond is either through the Skeptico Forum at skeptico-forum.com, which you can get to from the Skeptico website, which is at skeptiko.com. Or you can connect with me on Facebook, drop me an email, or leave a comment right there after the show notes. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptico. I do have several interesting episodes coming up. They're there. They're waiting. I hope my guests aren't going to be too frustrated at the delay that I'm experiencing between when I'm doing these interviews and when I'm getting them out. But I don't know. It's just part of the process, I guess. I'll try and do better, but I get anxious. I find people that I really want to talk to that I'm excited to, and I call them up and I do these interviews. And a lot of times I realize, oh my gosh, I got a few more than I can really get out. But that's part of the Skeptico thing for me. At any rate, I do appreciate you listening. Please tell your friends about Skeptico, blog about us, comment about us, tell other people what's going on here so they can share in what we're doing. And with that, do take care and bye for now.